We have a series of bills, just two housekeeping issues, colleagues. One is that Senate Bill 135, which was sent back from the floor because Senator Morse had some concerns. That was the electronic notary public bill. We got a proposed draft that will that is okay with Senator Morse, so we'll send that on for drafting. And you have that, Celia. Okay. And also, Senator Menace, we have the LC draft on the expedited Supreme Court hearing on the Judge Lipscomb decision, and I wanted you to look at it. I talked to Dave Hendricks about it. It doesn't have reference specifically to that that particular case, but that apparently is a an issue that Mr. Hendricks feels that he can't be any more specific than this, and the attorney for the PERS Coalition verified that this is the only case of its kind, so it satisfies the expedited hearing requirements. So if it's okay with you, I'll get that drafted up as well. Good. The rest of this stuff can wait. We have some guests here from, I would just hazard a guess, from the Veterans Administration. And so we're going to open our first hearing on Senate Bill 157. We'll open a public hearing. And on we have, ladies and gentlemen, a witness registration form. If any of you haven't signed this and wish to testify, I'll have you do so after Mr. Mangus and Jim Willis of the American Legion testify. So with that, do you gentlemen want to come up together or separately? It makes no difference to me. Welcome to the committee.
Can I proceed?
Yes, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Mangus. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And also here today are a number of individuals from the Department Advisory Committee, the chairman, Starl Austin, Walter Cruz, Evelyn Anderson, Hal Jordan, Bob Heltner, and also Jim Willis, except he's wearing a different hat today. And
he is wearing a hat, that's for sure.
And they are here in support of both of these bills, along with the support by the United Veterans Group of Oregon, a group of 13 separate organizations.
Mr. Mangus, I realized I made one slight error being new to this chair business. I didn't allow our staff to give an explanation of the bill. So can you wait just a second, please?
I sure can.
Sorry, Celia.
That's okay. Thank you. Senate Bill 157 authorizes Director of Veterans Affairs to be appointed conservator for dependents, immediate family members, survivors, and unmarried former spouses of persons qualified for veterans benefits.
Proceed, please, Mr. Mangus.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 157 has to do with the department's conservatorship program. It's a program that was established in 1964 to provide financial management for individuals who were unable to manage their own funds or were being abused by other persons. Today we provide financial management for 266 veterans and survivors, and these are individuals that the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs have determined are unable to manage their own funds and have gone to court, or another party has gone to court and requested that we act as conservator. And the reason they ask us is either, one, the estates are so small that other financial institutions are not interested in it because there would not be a fee available, or that the individuals are difficult to deal with, and 90% of the time, because they're rated for a psychological disability or a psych disability with drug alcohol abuse. In very unusual circumstances, and what this bill would do, would allow us to be the conservator of a veteran and a spouse or a child at the same time. And this does not happen very often, But when we get a request and we can't do that, then that party has to go to another institution or another party to ask them to act as conservator, and then another set of fees are involved, and there's difficulty in managing the two estates separately. What we like to do is, when that situation does arise and we're already conservator for the veteran, is to be able to take that added responsibility on. There's no additional staff, no fiscal impact, but it's one of those things that would not arise very often, but we want to be in a position to act when it does come up. And I would ask your support of Senate Bill 157.
Mr. Mangus, I guess the only question I'd have, I think I know the answer already, but is there any opposition to this bill that you know of?
There's no opposition that we know of, and we do have the support of the veteran community. And
okay, thank you. Did you have a question, Senator? Senator Menace?
John, if you go to the bill, help me understand this. I don't have a familiarity with what your program is specific, but I'm looking at the language of the bill, and I want to make sure we're saying what we mean. On line 5, it says, in addition to other powers and duties, the director of the Department of Veterans Affairs is authorized, and it skips down to line 28, number 7, to act without bond as a conservator of the estate of, and it says, a person who qualifies for benefits from the United States Department of Veterans Affairs. And we're deleting language where it says, when the director determines no other suitable person will so act. And it appears to me that by deleting that language and having it read as it does, that you would have the statutory authority to step in and be the conservator of any veteran who happens to qualify for benefits from the Department of Veterans Affairs. So I'm not sure that's what you mean to say.
Senator Cochran, Senator Menace, there are instances when another party is willing to act, a family member, but it has all been determined that that family member is the person who has been abusing the estate of that individual. And in those cases, you have somebody that's willing to act, but generally the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs does not want that person to act. And so we come into it, maybe by the back door.
Well, but are you proving my point? My assumption is that the granting of conservatorship comes through a judicial process, a hearing in front of a judge.
Right.
If the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs does not want a particular individual who's been abusing the estate of a veteran from being the conservator, wouldn't a judge take that into consideration? What I'm seeing the language of the bill doing is it's cutting out everybody else. It doesn't say anywhere in the bill then that this person might have standing to be conservator. And remember that judges are going to read it based on the plain meaning of the words in the law and nothing else. So you may intend one thing, but I think it's reading differently.
I guess, Mr. Chair, I wonder if it would help to get legislative counsel here to... I would guess that you explained the situation to legislative council. They brought forward the draft. Would it be helpful to...
This goes back a number of years from the original program was established, and the federal VA at that time, this is going back like 1960s and that they had to certify that no other person, suitable person, was willing to act as conservator. And so that's been in the law for a long time. And there was a change made here a couple sessions ago that allowed us to provide conservatorship services to... can't remember how the change was made. And it really kind of made that, it authorizes us now to act without bond as conserve the estate of persons who qualify for veterans from the United States Department of Veterans Affairs. Mm-hmm. And then it was just that additional language that was left there, when the director determines no other suitable person will so act.
Right.
And in a way, it's very difficult for me to say there's no other suitable person that will act.
But Mr. Chairman, John, I think what I'm trying to say is that the court wouldn't have any option. If there was a suitable person and your department did not want to necessarily be the conservator, I don't know that another person would have standing, because statutorily we're saying the Department of Veterans Affairs in Oregon has, as long as this person qualifies for benefits from the department, U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. So I guess I don't know that there would be a lot of occasions where you might have a person who is qualified and the department doesn't want to be the conservator, but the language here doesn't seem to provide an option for another suitable person to
there's
do that.
Been, as a rule, there is no other person. In the old days, well, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs would first go to the family to see if there was a family member that was willing to act, and then they would check around for the various financial institutions. First Interstate Bank and Bank of Oregon used to have conservatorship programs to see if they were willing to take it, and they did if the estate was large enough that they could obtain a fee from it. But then what happened is these people were disruptive, and the fee they received did not make up for the inconvenience of having them come into the lobby of the bank and make a scene because somebody else had their money. And but they actually went through that procedure of trying to find somebody else at that time. And that's where we, you know, were kind of into it from the beginning, when no other suitable person would act. Family members, as a rule, they would ask the family first because they thought it was kind of like a parental type responsibility to help the, you know, the son or the daughter out. But for the most part, because of the disabilities these people suffered, they may want to do it, but it put them in a bad position trying to manage the money of a child who was an adult child and had other problems. And it was the VA, the federal VA, that had this language put into the law when the program was first developed. And they no longer, you know, do that sort of thing. They would come directly to us and say, are you willing? And as a rule, we always say yes.
Are you?
And the courts, not us, make the actual appointment.
I understand, John. I'm just saying that the language as it's written here, I think, at least on its surface, excludes any other person from being a conservator. It looks to me like your agency would be the only agency authorized by statute to be the conservator.
Well, I just slipped a note that both our assistant AG that we work with and legislative counsel thought it should be written the way it is right now when the bill was drafted.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes no difference to me.
Senator Starr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Chair, Mr. Mangus, in line 5 of the bill, it says the Director of Veterans Affairs is authorized. It doesn't say is required. Wouldn't that make, just because you're authorized doesn't mean that you, when the circumstance arises, that you will automatically be required to assume the conservatorship.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Shed a little bit of.
I understand what you're saying, Senator, but that's not necessarily the way the court would interpret it. It may never become an issue. And I would be satisfied with language on line 5 at the end of where it says is authorized but is not required to. If that language was adopted, that makes sense. But again, I just know that the courts are interpreting things based on the plain meaning of the words, and the, you know, is authorized to act without bond as conservator. I don't know. Courts confuse me on a regular basis too. So,
well, I think, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, that they would also rely on committee testimony.
Well, actually, they do not. Interestingly, you want to have an opportunity to hear the Chief Justice talk about that whole issue. They do not. They tend to look specifically at the words. If the words are ambiguous, then they'll go to legislative history. Legislative history starts with the speeches carried by both the Senate and House carrier of the bill, and even then those speeches have to be substantially the same in order for it to carry weight with the court. They rarely ever get to the level of a committee discussion or a discussion among other members on the Senate or House floor. So it's given the way they're doing. So I just, what I'm trying to say is let's make sure that we're writing it the way you want it. Could there ever be a case or a time when there might be another conservator, another person would stand in?
Mr. Chair, Senator Menas, there has been instances. As a matter of fact, there's been instances when we felt there was not a need for a conservator, that an award could be made as a representative payee directly to a nursing home. So we didn't get into the process. This is, you know, like you've been talking about, it's a legal process, it's an expensive process, and if you don't need to go through it, instances like that, we don't.
Well,
this doesn't bother me at all, and if there was another person and they were qualified, I'd be more than happy to see them be conservator.
Why don't we do this? Instead of holding the bill up now, if we could, I'm fine with moving the bill.
Okay.
And I can state my point on the Senate floor or in a memo, but between now and by the time it gets to the House, maybe we could research a little bit better that question of how the language reads and what the courts might do with it. Because I think it may be very simple to fix or to make more clear, and it may not be a problem at all, but I'd like to hear a little more rationale from legislative counsel as to why it's okay, why it's permissive as opposed to...
I could also get our attorney, D. Carlson, to write a note on that that would probably explain his reasoning on this, too.
Yeah, I just have this policy, being the judiciary chair, that we write things as clearly as we possibly can, make sure we say what we mean.
Well, Senator Menas, when we give you the opportunity to carry the bill, you'll be able to make those comments directly on the Senate floor.
I'd be glad to carry it.
And actually, I think just it would be helpful to have either the AG that you work with or your attorney, as you mentioned, Mr. Mangus, write a couple of paragraphs on the intent of the language change, and following Senator Menas's lead, to indicate what the deletion does not mean. I think that's where you were going, wasn't it, Senator?
Right.
And be very explicit about the intent was not to open this up. So, how about Mr. Willis? Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Willis. I am the Legislative Commission Chair for the Department of Oregon American Legion, representing some 130 American Legion posts and some 30,000 Legionnaires. This bill was considered in the legislative agenda for the American Legion for the 72nd session of the Oregon Legislature, and our strong support of this bill is based on nearly four decades of a conservatorship role played by the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs that has established a reputation of absolute integrity in serving these veterans in need. And now the ability through this bill, if passed, to extend those services when needed to the dependents, immediate family members, survivors, and others, so that they can use these carefully controlled record keeping and financial disbursements in such a way as to sustain the rest of that veteran's family. This bill makes very good sense to us. This is the right department of state government to carry it on, and we strongly ask for your support of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Willis. Maybe we'll include your statement. That was pretty direct about the benefits of the bill. So.
You know, you've been in this building, Mr. Chair, a long time. When John Mangus was here in 1985 when I started, and Mr. Willis was with the Oregon State Police.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
But you guys are looking a lot older.
Well, I was going to speak to your age, but not to the witnesses' age, because we're told to be polite to the witnesses, not our own colleagues.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have absolutely no response to that.
Good bill should pass,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes. Good bill. We need to pass.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else wishing to testify on this? Seeing none, we'll close public hearing, open a work session on Senate Bill 157.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Menas.
I'll move Senate Bill 157 to the floor of the Senate. For the due pass recommendation.
Senator Menas moves the bill with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, please call the roll.
Senator Starr? Senator Watson?
Aye.
Vice Chairman Nunes?
Aye.
Chair Colquhoun?
Aye. The bill passes. Do you think this should be a consent calendar issue? Or?
I'd like to carry it.
Go ahead and carry it and have the vote on it. Okay, so Senator Menace will carry it, and we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 157 and open a public close the work session and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 193. And Ms. Nunez-Lopez, would you like to read the... Tell us what this bill does.
Senate Bill 193 increases maximum allowable veterans home loan amount.
Suspiciously enough, we have the same two gentlemen speaking on this bill. Would you step forward, please? I should have just told you to stay there. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman.
Sorry. Yes, Senator.
I'd like to move that we suspend the rules and allow Senator Starr to vote on Senate Bill 157.
Okay, we will close the... public hearing on Senate Bill 193 and return to the work session on Senate Bill 157. Senator Menace has asked that we suspend the rules to allow Senator Starr to vote on Senate Bill 157.
Okay.
Any opposition? Seeing none, Senator Starr, would you like to vote?
Certainly. We vote aye.
Senator Starr votes aye, so it's unanimous. Thank you very much. Thank you, Senator. We will close the work session on Senate Bill 157 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 193. And this increases the maximum allowable veterans home loan amount. I think I saw from 95 to 97% of the net appraised value. Go ahead, Mr. Mangus.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, John Mangus, Director of Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And with me is John Coffey, is the underwriter for the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Welcome.
Should anybody have a question on this that goes way beyond me. Senator Menace is real familiar with us over the years because he's a little bit older than I am. And it starts. But, you know, the Vets Loan Program got its start in 1945 for returning servicemen. And since that time, we've made over 330,000 loans to veterans here in the state of Oregon. And with a positive financial impact of over $7.4 billion into the state of Oregon. And over the years, the legislature has made a number of changes to help improve the program, and Senate Bill 193 is to make one additional small change. Currently, the home loans made by the department cannot exceed 95% of the net appraised value. And what this bill would do, it doesn't change the dollar amount that we can lend. What it does do is change the 95% of net appraised value to 97% of net, net appraised value. And that brings us in line with Fannie Mae lending standards, which probably brings us right up to speed. The only difference would be from other lenders is you have to be an Oregon veteran to qualify for this program. But the change, what it does or will do for the veteran borrower is going to reduce the upfront money that he has to have available to close the loan. And it doesn't enlarge the pool of veterans in any way, and it simply allows a few more of those that are already eligible to obtain home ownership, and everything else stays in place, the loan insurance requirements and that. And bring this to you requesting your support.
And for the record, Mr. Mangus, you said this program started in
1945? 1945.
And Senator Menace was one of the first applicants, is that what you said?
I think he has eligibility certificate number two.
Okay, thank you very much.
In all fairness...
Any questions of this doddering panel? Senator Menace, now you're in trouble, Mr. Mangus.
John, why an emergency clause?
Just so it would take effect and on the loans that are currently pending. And
Okay. You want to be able to apply it to current applications?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Right. What's the maximum loan amount now?
Boy, now you're not going to believe this, because when you got your home loan, you know, it was about $30,000 maximum at that time. Today it's $322,000.
Oh, all right. Now, do you have to be...
None of us in this room can afford that, but...
Now, how long out of the service do you have to be? I'm trying to figure out if I qualify.
the program basically is guided by the Oregon Constitution, Article 11A, which establishes eligibility. But we also are under the requirements established in the Internal Revenue Code for the issuance of qualified veteran mortgage bonds. So as far as the state of Oregon is concerned, and the IR, Internal Revenue Service, is you have to have entered the service prior to January 1, 1977, and then you have 30 years from your date of separation from active duty to use this program. So it's on the wind down, because it was primarily Vietnam veterans who are the last entitled individuals. But the Oregon legislature also passed, I think it was SJR 2, a few years ago, and that created ballot measure 83, which created a new set of eligibility for individuals who had service after 1976. And these were primarily, the legislature did that because at that time we saw Oregon National Guard people being mobilized and sent to Desert Storm, and since that time the Balkans, and we don't know what's going to happen right now, a large contingency just returned from the Sinai. And these individuals, when they go out to a hot spot like that, they earn a expeditionary or a campaign badge or a ribbon, and ballot measure 83 qualified these individuals to be eligible for the program. And these are generally younger guys just getting started, and a lot of times they don't have the dollars in the bank to come up with that large amount of clothing and that cost to the loan. So it's a good deal. It's had we had some hard times. The senator,
7 months left of eligibility. So
yeah, you better hurry.
So Senator Menace's time in the Confederate Army counts towards this. Is that what you're saying?
It did the last time he applied.
Okay,
so I'm
thank
sure
you very much.
Again this time.
Any other questions? Hearing none, Mr. Willis.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Willis, for the record, chair of the Legislative Commission of the American Legion in Oregon. Many people in this room, myself included, got their very first home based on an ODVA Veterans Home Loan. Through the action of this body, the post-76 veterans now, if qualified, can make application to this highly successful program. This bill, like the one we discussed earlier, is a very good bill. It extends this very successful Veterans Home Loan to even more qualified veterans, and it aligns the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs with other home loan lenders. So it basically levels the playing field. I strongly urge the committee on behalf of the American Legion and those veterans that qualify to support this bill and allow another very successful program in the Department of Veterans Affairs to be sustained and be available to those who qualify. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Willis. And I also want to thank the veterans who are here today in support of the bill. Thank you for coming to the Capitol. Mr. Mangus.
One more thing, Senator Cochran, that there is no known opposition to this and that I know of, and the advisory committee here is in support of it, and the United Veterans Group of Oregon is supporting it along with the American Legion. But I was also just told that I could say the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association, which used to be the Oregon Bankers Association supports this.
I am so surprised. Thank you so much. Okay, we will close the...
Where's the credit union league on this?
Yeah. Maybe we can ask... No, we won't ask Mr. Martinez. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 193, and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 193.
Sure.
Senator Menace?
I would move Senate Bill 193 unamended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Menace moves Senate Bill 193 unamended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll, please.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Minnis?
Aye.
Chair
Humphrey? Aye. The bill passes unanimously. Any volunteers for carrier?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes?
I'd like to move that we add this to the consent calendar.
Okay, there's a motion to add this to the consent calendar. Senator Walker, are you in agreement with that? I would guess you would be, but...
Yes.
Yes? Yes, since it's unanimous, we will do so. Thank you very much. We still need a carrier, though. Senator Menace will carry. Thank you. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 193, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 170. Ms. Nunez-Flores, would you please tell us what this bill does?
Senate Bill 170 clarifies age requirements for participation in various Oregon state lottery games.
And do we have a witness list for that?
Right.
Well, we have the new chair of the Lottery Commission with us. Well, welcome, Ms. Rockland. And I would assume you are Mr. Steiner?
Yes, sir.
With the Oregon State Police. Welcome, both of you. And
Mr. Chair.
Please begin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brenda Rockland, the interim director of the Oregon Lottery. With me today is Lieutenant Tim Steiner, a member of the Oregon State Police and the director of security for the Oregon Lottery. And we are testifying today in support of Senate Bill 170. This bill simply makes it clear that no one under the age of 21 years can play video lottery or claim a video lottery prize. Under current Oregon law, the lottery statutes do not expressly set forth age limits as to video lottery games. Instead, what Oregon law does is provide that video lottery terminals must be placed in an age control area posted by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. And the issue that Senate Bill 170 seeks to address is the fact that under OLCC rules, certain underage individuals can lawfully be present in certain age-controlled areas, particularly spouses of individuals who are over the age of 21. And what this bill does is to make it clear that even if an underage person is lawfully inside an age control area, they cannot play a video lottery game. The bill would also provide that retailers who knowingly allow underage players to play video lottery games could have their contracts with the Oregon Lottery terminated. We urge your support of Senate Bill 170, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I guess the only question that occurs to me, Ms. Rockland, is has there been a problem with this that you know of, or maybe that's more appropriate to Officer Steiner?
Mr. Chair, I'll let Lieutenant Steiner address that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Lieutenant Steiner with the Oregon State Police. It's not an ongoing problem, but an occasional problem from time to time. Fairly rare, but it does occur occasionally.
Okay, thank you. Did you have testimony that you wanted to give?
No, sir. I was here to answer questions.
That's a very good thing. Pardon me? So the sort of problem that would be caused would be the presence of this underage person in an age-appropriate place and actually trying to claim a ticket?
That's correct. Yes.
So the person, the over 21, cashes out the ticket and hands it to the other person and they go try to cash it. So this is to prohibit that?
Right.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions?
Well, I'm just shocked, Mr.
Senator Walker.
Yeah, I'm just shocked that we don't have this in statute already. It was always my understanding you had to be 21 to play. Amazing. Thank you.
Thank you for bringing this to our attention. Any other questions? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 170, and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 170.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Menace.
Senate Bill 170 to the floor of the Senate unamended. A due pass recommendation.
Senator Menace moves Senate Bill 170 to the floor unamended with a due pass recommendation. Ms. Gravel, will you please call the roll? Well, any discussion? Seeing none, please call the roll.
Senator Scott?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Menace?
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 170, should we be considering this for consent calendar? Okay, I have a nod from everybody, so we will put this on the consent calendar. And any volunteers? Senator Starr? Thank you very much. Senator Starr will carry. We will close the work session on 170, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 171 with the same suspects in front of us. Would you please explain what that bill does, Ms. Nunez-Flores?
Certainly. 171 limits certain requirements for lottery game drawings to games that utilize manual prize drawing.
Thank you. Again, we have Brenda Rockland from the Oregon Lottery here and Lieutenant Tim Steiner from the State Police. Welcome again.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, Brenda Rockland, Interim Director of the Oregon Lottery, and Lieutenant Tim Steiner from the State Police and the Director of Security at the Oregon Lottery. This is another lottery bill that is really meant to update existing law to take into account certain technological changes, specifically the lottery's use of random number generators. Under existing law, a number of statutory requirements must be met when the Oregon Lottery uses a drawing to conduct a game. For example, when a drawing occurs, the statute requires that there needs to be an independent auditor present. The equipment must be inspected before and after the drawing. And the intent of Senate Bill 172 is to make it clear that those statutory requirements that apply to a drawing and would apply only to a, quote, manual drawing, end quote. And by that, I'm referring to what I'm certain the committee is familiar with in the past when the lottery has used an air-driven device that has the numbered balls in the air. So that in that particular instance, the statutory requirements would still be required, but they would not be required when the lottery uses the random number generators. And that's the random number generators is the type of technology that the Oregon Lottery currently uses to conduct its games. So we're simply asking that the statutory requirements be clarified to apply only to the manual drawings.
Go ahead, Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you just tell me which games the lottery does currently that is the manual drawing of winning numbers?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, none would be the answer to that. At the current time.
Okay.
Do you have any questions? Further questions? Are you wondering why we need to do this if it's not even?
I'm wondering. Maybe Senator Mendeskin has.
Well, I'm wondering if Ms. Rockland would tell us that maybe they anticipate doing this at some point in the future. I'm not sure.
Mr. Chair, that could be a possibility. I think the concern behind this bill, though, is that if it were to be interpreted that drawing included the use of the random number generators that we use now, that those statutory requirements then could result in a number of conditions that would be pretty cost prohibitive for the Oregon Lottery in terms of having an independent auditor sit there and essentially look at a computer generate numbers. So it was really more of a concern about whether those statutory requirements would be in place under the use of technology that's used now.
Senator? Just Mr. Chair, begs the question of if they don't have manual drawings, why are we referencing that in the statute as opposed to this random number generated method? But
because of the requirements that there be an auditor and so forth, that they're trying to single out the fact that their number generators wouldn't require the same level of scrutiny.
I understand that, but if we're not using the manual lottery number drawing processes within the Oregon Lottery, it seems odd to me that we're referencing that in the statute. I understand the need to, as far as having auditors watch a computer screen, but it seems interesting that we leave the statute as it is, referencing manual drawing of winning numbers.
Lieutenant, would you like to respond?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the perfect example is a Megabucks drawing. It used to be manual. And as the statute was written, it was correct. But in a cost-saving measure and to reduce the number of people needed and actually make it even more secure, it was automated. Now, as the language reads now, since it's automated, it still requires to have an external auditor, OSP, and those people would be there. And in essence, what the statute reads, it requires people to watch a computer just run. So by inputting the language manual, it fixes that.
Okay. Senator Starkingwell.
I completely understand what I know. I completely understand what you're saying. It seems to me that the language overall needs to be reworked significantly to match current technology, as opposed to trying to manipulate the existing language to fix a problem. We ought to just rewrite the whole thing, but that's not what we're here to do today. So I know I'll support this bill because I understand where you're headed with it, but it just seems odd that I think it'd probably be ripe for some significant rewriting.
Just for the record, just could one of you please explain to me the changes in the elimination of 2D and the addition of 3A? It looks to be fairly similar. Why that was suggested? Is it again just reflecting the manual?
Mr. Chair, that's my understanding.
Yes.
We're having a quick note handed up from the back row. Unfortunately, it's in a foreign language.
No, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to relay that, is that, and potentially this response to some extent to Senator Starr's question, is that the lottery could do manual drawings for second chance drawings, so there may be an occasion when the manual drawings could be used, and it may be important then to have those statutory requirements in place.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Perfect.
Okay. Anybody else wish to testify? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 171, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 171.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I move Senate Bill 171 unamended to the Senate floor for the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr recommends sending Senate Bill 171 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, Ms. Gravel, will you please call the roll?
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Walker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Minnis.
Aye.
Chair
Buckley. Aye. It is a unanimous vote. Consent calendar. Yes, yes, yes. Consent calendar. Just because it involves old language, I'll carry it. Close Senate Bill 171, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 209. And I will be awaiting a testimony witness registration here. We have Carol Halford from the Architects Board and Cindy Robert. You want to testify separately or together? Together, okay. And if you'll wait just a moment, please, we'll have Ms. Nunez-Flores let us know what this bill does.
Senate Bill 209 allows qualifying architects licensed outside Oregon to provide architectural services in affiliation with Oregon Architect having responsible control of work.
Thank you very much. I wanted to let colleagues know that I received... Oh, here's the letter from Mr. Sider is here, from Bill Sider, who's one of the board members. I received the letter and hadn't gotten it to you folks yet, but it's been entered in the record. So, Ms. Halford, welcome.
Thank you. Chairman Corcoran, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Carol Halford, and I'm the administrator of the Oregon Board of Architect Examiners. And under the existing rules and statutes, only an architect registered in Oregon may practice architecture or use the title architect. The board believes this is a good law that benefits the public, but the board is asking you to consider this bill to amend that law just slightly. If passed, this bill would allow architects licensed outside of Oregon to receive credit and recognition for the work they do if they work with an Oregon registered architect on projects here in this state. The architect of record would still be required to be licensed in Oregon, but architects licensed outside of Oregon and in foreign countries could use a special designation as either a consulting or foreign architect and receive credit for the work they do on projects here. Just to clarify, a consulting architect are those licensed in Canada and other states outside of Oregon, and foreign architects are those licensed in countries outside the U.S. or Canada. The board believes this bill allows an opportunity for greater collaboration of talent and expertise on projects being designed in Oregon. The current laws discourage such assistance, and the proposed changes would provide incentive for quality architects to assist with projects in this state that would allow clients of architectural services to retain the highest level of services available, not just in Oregon, but in the world. So, as you noted, Senator Corcoran, there is a letter from Bill Sider, one of our board members, in the packet, and he and I both are asking for the committee's support and consideration on this bill.
And Ms. Halford, is there any opposition to the bill that you're aware of?
No known opposition.
Thank you very much,
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Menace?
Can we go into work session?
Yes, do you... Ms. Robert doesn't care, does she?
I've been rejected so many times today that go right ahead.
But this is a good rejection, okay? All right, we'll close the public hearing or open work session on Senate Bill 209.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Menace.
I move Senate Bill 209 to the floor of the Senate with a pass recommendation.
Senate Bill, Senator Bill. Senator Menace moves Senate Bill 209 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none. Ms. Gravel, please call the roll.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chairman?
Aye.
Chair Corcoran?
Aye. It is unanimous. Colleagues, consent calendar?
Please.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Okay, consent calendar. Any carriers? Any volunteers? Okay, Senator Walker, thank you very much. Senator Walker will carry. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 209, open a work session on Senate Bill 210, and please tell us what that does, Ms. Nunez. Pardon me?
Public hearing.
Did I say work session? Yeah. I'm sorry, we're in public hearing on 210, Senate Bill 210.
Senate Bill 210, redefine practice of architecture.
Okay, that first packet, did you give everybody that clipped together packet?
Yes.
That you gave me? The colleagues, that first packet also had letters in support of 210 and 211, just FYI, if you didn't see that. Okay. We have Ms. Halford.
Thank you. Again, my name is Carol Halford, the administrator of the Oregon Board of Architect Examiners. The board considers Senate Bill 210 really a housekeeping bill that proposes four changes. It looks rather complicated. Section 1 and 3 of the bill simply switches language to the appropriate section of law identifying what is and is not the practice of architecture that should better organize and clarify the language. Section 2 is a wording change that meets the model law of the National Council of Architectural Registration Boards. We call it NCARB. NCARB's most recently published model law mission statement is, or should be, also in your packet and shows that they use the phrase health, safety, and welfare. The board wants to match that common reference and terminology. They do so in all other aspects. It's just simply not in their statute that way. Section 4 does two things. It changes one of its license statuses from a suspended and good standing status to an inactive status, which sounds less like discipline and more accurately reflects the actual license status. In addition, it also clarifies license renewal deadlines to what has been established by rule back in 1992. Ever since July 1 of 1992, architects have renewed their license every year by July 1st. That does now create a conflict because the statute is different. The board would like to continue to keep the July 1st deadline. Without this change, there would be a negative impact on the board's revenues and expenditures for at least one biennium while we catch up and transition back to what the statute currently states. Lastly, Section 5 clarifies that there's a fee for taking not only the National Architect exam, but also for the application for determining eligibility to sit for that same exam. The fee is outlined, both of those fees actually are outlined in the board's rules, as is allowed by this same statute, but putting them both together in the statute might clarify it more for licensees. The board would like their laws to be a little more organized and understandable and believes this bill accomplishes that, and we're asking for your support.
Thank you, and there is a letter again from Mr. Sider and from their board recommending. Is any non-opposition?
None.
Seeing none.
I just have one question.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Halford, what is a registration fee to be an architect in Oregon?
Senator Walker, Chair Corcoran, it's $100.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm just doing a short little study.
Maybe you're considering a midlife change in occupation. Not that you're at midlife yet. We will close the...
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
Oh. I'm sorry, you're not on the list.
Well,
you can't speak.
On the first one, I signed up for all three, and I was going to ask permission to speak to all three at once, but...
That would be just fine.
My efforts were thwarted.
And this one might be thwarted as well? Okay, we will close. No, go ahead. We know you'll be brief. We know you'll be very brief.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert. I represent the American Institute of Architects of Oregon. It's a national organization. It's broken down into regional, state, and local chapters. You won't always see the two of us sitting at the same table, but I'm happy to come here today at Mr. Sider's request and support these bills. We do have some concerns that there's some unintended consequences of some of the language in Senate Bill 210, but we'd be happy to talk outside of this chamber and in the House chamber about whether we need some amendments. So beyond that, we're very supportive.
Our hearts soar like an eagle. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 210, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 210.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Menace.
Based on Ms. Roberts' wholehearted endorsement of this bill, I move Senate Bill 210 to the floor of the Senate and do pass. Recommendation, unamended.
Okay. Senator Menace recommends moving Senate Bill 210 to the floor unamended with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none. Ms. Gravel, will you please call the roll?
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chairman?
Aye.
Chair Corcoran?
Aye. Senate Bill 210 is unanimous. Consent calendar? Yes. Yes. Senator Walker, you're yes.
Yes. I'm
it moves to the consent calendar, and anybody want to carry it? I'll carry it. That's fine. Who's doing 209? Senator Walker, okay.
I'm doing 209. Do you want me to do 210 also?
Well, these three are a package. It might be just easy to package them all together for the statements on them, if that makes sense to you.
Okay.
Okay, Senator Walker will carry that. Thank you. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 210. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 211. Ms. Nunez-Flores, please tell us what that does.
Senate Bill 211 expands disciplinary authority of State Board of Architects Examiners.
Thank you very much. And surprisingly enough, we have Carol Halford from the Architect Board to tell us about this bill.
Well, thank you. One more time, my name is Carol Halford with the Architect Board. And under the existing rules and statutes, the board may carry out discipline against architects and prevent those who wish to become licensed and practice architecture in this state. The board believes the authority is an important piece to the board's protection of the public. The Architect Board is asking you to consider this bill to allow the board to take action for two additional key reasons. One is for being convicted of a crime relating to the practice of architecture, and the other for being disciplined by another state. This bill is really a preventative public protection measure allowing the board authority to take action against improper conduct. The board would still provide an opportunity for a hearing and would follow due process before taking any final action for any reason. In addition to my testimony, you also have a letter from Bill Sider. And unless there's any questions, that concludes my testimony.
Any questions, colleagues? I guess my only question would be along the line of you know, why do we need this bill? How many times in the past 10 years has the state board either denied a license or what are your three options here? Not renew, suspend, or revoke a person's license?
Chairman Corcoran, members of the committee, do you mean for any reason at all? I haven't been with the board for only 2 years. During the last two-year period, I can tell you we have revoked one license and we are in the process of denying another that may or may not, depending on the contested case hearing process. Beyond that, I'd have to do research and get back with you on the answers.
I was just kind of curious about the necessity for the bill. Senator?
Okay. Carol, could you, what kind of liability do architects have for not performing their work? Or correct, not performing it correctly?
Well, Vice Chair Minnis and members of the committee, the board has the authority to revoke or suspend or do all of those things for not performing.
But the architect, what kind of liability do they have for failing to comply with the Uniform Building Code? Or
I believe the answer to your question is a contractual one, and that is not in the same purview as the architect board's laws and rules. Generally speaking, that goes to civil court, and they duke it out there.
Civilly liable.
Yes.
Senator Starr?
I'm following up on that. There isn't a statutory requirement on a certain amount of liability insurance for an architect to become a licensed architect in the state?
Senator Starr, members of the committee, no. Not by our statutes or rules.
And Mr. Chairman?
Senator Minnis?
No bond requirement.
I'm sorry?
No bond requirement.
None.
Thank you.
Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 211, open a work session on Senate Bill 211.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Minnis.
Move Senate Bill 211 to the floor of the Senate with the due pass recommendation unamended.
Senator Minnis moves Senate Bill 211 to the floor with the unamended, with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none. Ms. Gravel, please call the roll.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Minnis?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye. It's unanimous. I assume we'll put that on the consent calendar as well. Senator Walker will carry. Closes the work session on Senate Bill 211. And colleagues, the only thing I'd say before we adjourn is that we're going to move Senator Menace's expedited hearing on the Lipscomb case. We have a draft of a mortuary bill that I'll bring you some information on, and we will schedule Senate Bill 96. I don't think we'll have the amendments done to 135, but we'll schedule Senate Bill 96 for the next time, and I think at that point we're caught up, so my guess is we'll be in and out of here very quickly on Wednesday, unless we had asked for some information from the PERS folks, but they haven't gotten that back yet, so I think we'll just do I guess, unless it's the will of the committee, if we only have the one bill before us, if you want to just forego the Wednesday meeting, probably be more constructive use of our time to combine stuff for later meetings. Okay, so we will not hold any work session or public hearings on Wednesday the 29th, and we're adjourned. Thank you very much.
Is that